she knew already. Pilots generally came from aristocracy and possessed a certain sense of entitlement. Third pilot Magus, still in the brig, had been part of the first mutiny. With the self-destruct process already started, however, Hobbs would have to turn Frick. And for that, she realized, she had waited too long. The Ricks were almost upon them. There was no chance that the Lynx could survive another pass from the battlecruiser. The captain was right about one thing. Suicide was the only sure way of destroying the object. She let all the mutinous thoughts exit her mind. It was a pointless exercise. They were all dead, whatever she did. But Kathryn cursed herself for not deciding. Honorable death or mutiny, she could have made a choice when the Ricks were still distant. Instead, she had waited for time to run down. Lawrence Zai and Watson Frick, they had chosen their deaths. Kathryn Hobbs had merely stumbled into hers.
Fail safe in 10, Frick said.
Collision in 20,
a pilot added. This was it. Just a countdown remained, and there was no meaning in it for Hobbs.
Captain,
cried Ensign Tyre. The Ricks!
Cut our acceleration, pilot,
Zai snapped.
Stand by, Frick.
The captain waved his hand, and the Ricks battlecruiser filled the big air screen. It was coming alight. A storm of explosions ran up and down the length of its hull. Bright arms of white energy burst from its sides, curving around to strike back at the vessel like arcing solar flares. The ship's main drive continued to fire, but it was free of its structural supports, spinning like a fire hose gone wild within the mighty ship. The blazing shaft cut the battlecruiser's aft section to pieces, then the drive tore itself free from the ship and jetted whirling into the void. The kilometer-long bow spar of the battlecruiser vanished into a nuclear blast, perfectly spherical and absolutely white.
Frick, first pilot, save us,
the captain ordered.
Aye, aye, sir.
Hobbs felt herself growing heavy as the Lynx's faltering gravity strained to mask their deceleration. The whine of the singularity alarm slowly lessened as Frick brought it out of its critical cycle. Kathryn watched in amazement as debris scattered from the battlecruiser. She couldn't believe the huge ship had disintegrated so quickly. 1,000 Ricks women had died in seconds, and her own fate had been recalled from the precipice just as suddenly. The captain leaned back into the shipmaster's chair. Hobbs saw for the first time how white his face had become, how tired he looked. Zai's grim expression had seemed so fatal. Now the old man looked merely exhausted.
They made their decision rather more quickly than I expected, he said to her. Given the light-speed delay, it must have taken about 10 seconds for the Ricks commanders to decide. They must have been ready in case we discovered a way to threaten the object.
Hobbs could only say,
You knew what they would do?
As I said, when a living god is at stake, self-destruction is the only honorable choice.
Hobbs tried to wrap her mind around his words. He'd been playing chicken, for heaven's sake, but
why did they self-destruct, sir?
They were too distant to stop us, but too close to veer off, Zai said. This was the correct moment to initiate our self-destruction, because it left them no choice but their own. Now that they're gone, we don't have to destroy the object. Hobbs looked at the sparkling screen. She'd never seen anything so final.
But all those women...
The Ricks think nothing of their own lives, Hobbs. Only their minds matter to them. They've risked war to create this new breed of god. They couldn't let it die. No price was too high.
She swallowed.
I'm not sure, sir. If I were them, I'd have a backup plan.
Zai managed to smile, but she saw the relief in his eyes. He had by no means been sure how this would turn out.
What sort of plan, Hobbs?
I don't know, sir, she said quietly. But they wouldn't leave us free to capture their living god, would they?
Zai spread his hands.
The situation gave them the choice of two evils, I suppose. They knew that we were willing to die for our faith as much as they. We weren't bluffing, Hobbs.
Then he laughed tiredly.
But we seem to be alive. Perhaps their faith is stronger than ours.
The words stung Kathryn. Facing death, her mind had been consumed by options, by ways to avoid the Lynx's fate. She had even considered treachery. She was not worthy to wear this uniform.
Sir, she said.
Yes, Hobbs.
There's something I should tell you. I don't deserve...
She started, then swallowed.
When we were about to...
Sir, interrupted Tyre. Report. Hidden in the battle cruiser's debris, sir. I'm getting spherical shapes against the background radiation.
The captain swore.
Black body drones.
The Ricks had indeed had a backup plan. Hobbs took over.
Pilot, 6G's on a quick slope, lateral to the battlecruiser's last vector. Now!
The bridge crew were wrenched by torque as the ship spun to align her main drives. A gunner was thrown from his station into the airscreen pit, skidding through the false sights of synesthesia as if sliding down a hill.
Shit!
Thought Hobbs. The artificial gravity generator was growing chancier by the minute. And the bridge was almost dead center of the links. What was happening at the extremes where that quick yaw was no doubt snapping like a whip? Hobbs punched through internal views. She saw crew thrown against walls and ceilings, more casualties, but no decompression. The AG was prioritizing structural integrity. Then the drive fired and she was pushed back into her chair. As her weight increased, Hobbs found herself gasping for breath. Gravity diagnostics were blank and white dots had appeared at the edge of her primary vision. She wondered if the gravity generators had failed altogether. The Lynx AI would normally intervene in such a situation and shut the drive, but with the frigate taking hits from enemy fire, the software would blindly accept dangerous acceleration. Hobbs could get no response from diagnostics. Processor capacity was falling. The Lynx's silicon phosphorus columns were succumbing to the heavy G's. Giant hands pushed against her chest. Without dampening, everyone on the bridge would be unconscious in 20 seconds. Six uncorrected G's would injure and kill hundreds. But hurtling silently toward the Lynx were more black-body drones, ready to unleash their incredible firepower at a ship whose armor had been stripped to the minimum. Hobbs's fingers struggled to gesture as the pressure on her body increased. She finally found a reading from a mechanical accelerometer buried deep in the executive officer's interface. 3 G's uncorrected and climbing. Something was very wrong.
Cut the burn to 2 G's, she cried.
One of the pilots lifted a heavy hand to execute the order. Suddenly, the bridge was filled with blazing shapes. Bright traces of light whipped past Hobbs, burning themselves into her eyes. Anvil booms broke against her ears, and her nose filled with the foundry smell of superheated metal. Hobbs heard human screams amid the cries of decompression and rending hypercarbon. Then the hail of projectiles ended. Hobbs felt her weight still growing. She looked across the bridge airscreen. 2 gunners and all 3 pilots were torn and bloody. Caught in the sudden fusillade of black-body drone fire, they'd been torn to pieces.
Captain! She cried.
Zai's head had rolled back, his eyes opened dully. There was no blood on his face. Of course, Hobbs realized. His artificial limbs were strong, but the acceleration must be tearing up the delicate interface between the prosthetics and his sundered body. All around her, the Lynx was trembling. If the AG failed completely, 6 G's would crumple the frigate like paper. Hobbs's accelerometer read 4.4. Processor capacity was dropping like a stone as the frigate's columns of silicon and phosphorus shattered under their own suddenly immense weight. Synesthesia grew blurrier by the second. It was only a matter of time before gestural commands were useless. Hobbs strained to pull herself from her chair. There were manual drive cutoffs all through the ship, human-operated. There was one a few meters from her among the ragdoll corpses at the first pilot's station. Why hadn't the drive engineers already acted? They should have realized what was happening by now and shut the drive down. But were any of them conscious? They were at the ship's aft extreme, where the whip of the frigate's undampened yaw had done its worst damage. Hobbs had to reach the pilot station. Again, she pushed against her chair and managed to pull herself up. She took one unsteady step, bowed like a woman carrying 100 kilos of stone on her back. Her hand reached out to grab the rail that surrounded the airscreen pit. But she was too heavy. She faltered. Her legs gave way. Her knee thundered down against the metal deck like a jackhammer and exploded with pain. Suddenly, everything was silent and dark. Hobbs's ears heard only the far-off whine of some alarm. Second-sight icons floated in the air, gibberish now. Everything seemed to be drifting around her. Then Hobbs realized that she was floating. Freefall. Someone had cut the drive. Her blood was no longer gravity's hostage, and she could feel it rushing back into her head. Hobbs opened her eyes. Lucidity fought with the pain screaming in her knee. The bridge spun slowly around her, full of unfamiliar shapes and smells. The pilots were dead, and all of the gunners had been hit. A haze of ichor filled the air. Blood pumped from a gunner's chest wound, spurted globules rolled lazily through the air.
Medical! Medical! She said.
But she heard the words echoed from all through the ship. Hobbs twisted to grab the airscreen rail. but the motion wrenched her shattered knee and she passed out from the pain. 10 years earlier, Imperial Absolute. House. It had taken a whole day to sculpt, shaping the snows with reflected sunlight, vented geothermal and the occasional infralaser, but the sled trail was ready at last. It stretched 10 kilometers, spiraling down the house's mountain peak through 4 circumnavigations before tipping through a narrow pass and down a steep moraine. The trail then descended into a glacial rift between towering walls of ancient blue ice and terminated at one of the house's water-gathering points, now fitted with an access tunnel. For safety, the entire course was banked with 3 meters of powdery snow and marked with cheery orange glow sticks at every turn. The house was quite proud of itself. At last, its encyclopedic knowledge of every centimeter of the estate had been put to use. But not everything was under control. The mistress's guest had insisted on building the sled himself. Captain Zai had requested a bewildering variety of materials to be synthesized, adapted, and cannibalized. Apparently, sleds on Vader were made entirely of animal bone and skins, lashed together like macrame inside a hard frame. The house had serious reservations about trusting the mistress's safety to such a contraption, which had no internal diagnostics, native intelligence, or self-repair capacity. Still, the house was impressed when Captain Zai finished winding the strips of salvaged leather garments around the mock ivory runners and frame, and jumped onto the sled, testing it with his full weight several times. The leather stretched, but held, the force elegantly distributed throughout the frame. "How long have Vadens been building those?" the mistress asked. 20,000 years, was Zai's nonsensical answer. The house knew that Vader had only been colonized for 15 centuries. 20 millennia ago was a time before the diaspora. "You certainly hold on to the old ways," Zai nodded. "Ever seen one before?" "A sled? Laurent, I'd never seen snow before coming to home. There isn't any on Vasthold. Well, perhaps at the poles, but we haven't gotten that crowded yet." The house read surprise on the captain's face. "You'd never seen snow? And you bought a house in the Antarctic? That was adventurous." "Adventure had nothing to do with it. Home is more crowded than Vasthold. This is the only place on the planet I can withdraw completely from apathy. But it's true, I always did want to see snow. On Vasthold, we have children's tales about it." "About sisters lost in a blizzard?" Zai asked, freezing to death. "God spite, Laurent, no. I grew up thinking snow was magical stuff. Rain turned white and powdery. Pillow feathers from the sky." Zai smiled. "You're about to find out just how right you were." He hoisted the 2.5 meters of skin and pseudo-bone onto his shoulder. The mistress narrowed her eyes at the sled, rising a little hesitantly. "It looks sound enough," she said. "Shall we find out?" The house's mind shot down the sled trail again, searching once more for a poorly banked turn, a hidden crevasse, a dangerous ice patch. All seemed in order. As the mistress and her guest changed into warmer clothes, the house connected with the planetary infrastructure, accessing several collections of oral and written folklore. In seconds, it had discovered hundreds of children's stories from Vasthold and many more from the older world of Vader. Then its search spilled across the many planets where the two worlds' founder populations had originated, and hits came in the tens of thousands. The house found tales of animated snowmen and wish-granting white leopards, magical Arctic storms and strandings on ice floes, stories of how the aurora was made and why the compass sometimes lied. It even found the tales I had mentioned, entitled 3 Vaden Sisters Lost in a Blizzard. The two headed for the east door, the leather of the handmade sled creaking softly as the captain carried it downstairs. For the next minute or so, they couldn't hurt themselves. The house settled in for a pleasant 100 seconds of reading. Captain. "Of course, when I mentioned sledding, I didn't mean downhill, nothing quite so childish. Well, Laurent, we couldn't very well fly in a team of dogs." "True, but what's a country house without dogs, Nara?" "Dogs aren't fashionable on home, I'm afraid." He sighed. "So I'd noticed." Zai turned down the heating in his uniform. His metabolism was enough to keep him warm inside navy wool. The snow crunched under his boots with the bright sound of a recent fall. Perfect powder for sledding. If only he had a long, flat stretch of it and a team of huskies. Nara's blue eyes were flashing with a smile. I'm relieved to see that you Vadens don't slavishly follow the Emperor's taste in these matters. Laurent cleared his throat. There's nothing wrong with cats, strictly speaking. The trail began only a few meters from the door. It was shiny and slick, as if incised into the snow with lasers. On the mountain side of the trail, the snow had been melted into an overhang, forming a half-cylinder of ice that wound downward around the peak. On the other side loomed a vertiginous drop. Zai felt a bit dizzy, possibly from exhaustion. With only an hour of darkness every night, they hadn't slept much in the last 3 days. He took a deep breath. I hope your house knows what it's doing. Sometimes I think my house knows altogether too much, Nara said. It has an excess of time on its hands. Zai looked up at the building, which seemed quite modest from the outside. Most of its bulk was hidden within the stone of the mountain, its true extent revealed only by the glimmer of 100 polarized windows. Not all looked out from Nara's living quarters, of course. He had toured the gardens this morning, or at least some of them. The warrens that had produced 3 days of sumptuous meals seemed endless. That sort of decadence always resulted when machines were given too much autonomy. Zai adjusted his tunic waist, which was growing tighter by the day. I get the feeling it can still hear us, he said. Probably. She shrugged in her coat. Laurent pulled the glove from his real hand and ran his fingers through the short, yellow-gray fur. Para-coyote, Nara said. His eyes widened. You're wearing a canine? That's a crime on Vader. She laughed. They're a pest on Vasthold, to say the least. Zai wondered if Nara knew how extraordinary it was to come from a planet where pest could mean something bigger than an insect. On Vader, hunting was only allowed on stocked private lands, a sport for the unthinkably rich. Vasthold is fortunate that terraforming has taken so well. Did you kill it yourself? No, I haven't hunted since I was a kid, she smiled, fingering the fur. And then only with a slingshot. This was a political gift from a conservationist group. But taken in the wild with a bow, I think. Zai shook his head. We have no wild mammals on Vader. He placed the sled on the snow. I wish I could take you on a proper sled ride, Nara, with a team of huskies across a floe of new sea ice. Sea ice? You mean without land underneath? It's very smooth when it's new. No, thank you. Well, after a few days of strong wind, pressure ridges break up the landscape. She laughed. It's not the monotony, Laurent. It's the thought of nothing but ice between me and an ocean. There is safety equipment when you fall through... When? He cleared his throat again. Perhaps we should get started. Yes, I'm beginning to think you're delaying us intentionally. Afraid of heights, Laurent? He looked down the trail. The surface looked somewhat glassy, a bit fast. Too slick for dog's feet, certainly. He wondered if the runners would find any purchase to keep them on the track. The trail was banked to keep them from flying off the mountain, but they had no way to control their speed. Not heights. What then? Putting my life in the hands of an AI. She smiled and sat down on the front of the sled. Come on, Laurent, it's a very clever house. It was marvelous. The sled accelerated quickly like a dropship spiraling down a gravity well. Laurent clung to it fiercely, his fingers wound into the leather straps that held it together. The runners found the ruts pre-cut deep into the ice and stayed in them, banking comfortably with the turns. The trail seemed never to pass into the shadow of the mountain. The clever house reflected sunlight from the surrounding peaks, the snow in their path glowing with the warm red of the rising sun. But his eyes still reduced to slits against the wind. The crisp air turned, freezing by their velocity. Nara leaned back into Laurent's chest, laughing hysterically, her arms wrapped around his legs. She was warm, and her chaotic hair brushed his cheeks. He squeezed his knees together tightly to hold her in the plummeting sled and to keep her warmth against him. After 4 turns around the mountain, the trail slanted upward, slowing them as it straightened. The rise hid the terrain before them. I'd do that again, Laurent shouted as the sled came almost to a halt. I don't think it's done, Nara said, shaking her head. Are you familiar with the term
roller coaster?
I don't think... Godspite!
The sled had crested the rise, revealing a gut-loosening decline dotted with giant boulders. The trail ahead was lined with high snowbanks, but the ruts guiding the runners suddenly disappeared, leaving the sled free for the straight decline. The slope was 45 degrees at least.
It's trying to kill us! Zaya shouted. We'll see!
Laurent and Nara clutched each other, screaming as the sled dropped into the canyon of ice. After the acceleration of the first mad drop, the trail leveled, descending gradually between icy walls. The exposed interior of the glacier was deep blue, the color of a clear Vaden sky on the day of apogee. In the rift's protection, the air was still except for the wind of their passage, but Laurent held his lover closer. He touched his lips to her left ear, which was bright red and as cold as the metal buttons of her coat. Remember when I said we had no technology for slowing down time? He whispered. Yes. I was wrong. This lasts forever. She reached back and put a gloved finger to his lips softly, and Laurent felt foolish. It wasn't right to speak of these things. This was a fragile endlessness, soon followed by an onrushing of events that would part them for decades. Tomorrow, they would take the suborbital back to the capital. The commissioning of the links was set for the day after. On home, any such event would be a tremendous affair, lasting an entire night and filling the great square before the Diamond Palace with supplicants, zealots, and status seekers. After that, Captain Zai had only a matter of weeks to train his crew in orbit before leaving for Legius. But he had these moments here with Nara. Against the weight of years and the depredations of the time thief, he had only the sharp and brittle thing that was now. Laurent wondered if it were possible that any alliance formed across days could really last decades. Or would what they'd shared in this icy waste prove illusory, born of torturous memories, lack of sleep, and the romance of its own improbability? Of course, Laurent realized, what was real or unreal would be determined in the years to follow. Falling in love was never genuine in itself. What had happened in these 4 days would be given meaning over their decades apart. Like some figment of the quantum, love was made true only when measured against the rest of the world. The sled was slowing, and Laurent Zai sighed softly to himself. Thinking of the future, he had missed the present. Nara kissed him and stood. They were at the blind end of the rift. What now? Climb out? He looked back up the trail at the kilometers distant house, just visible on its mountain peak. It would take hours. Nara shook her head and pointed to a patch of icicles, which shattered as something metal rumbled behind it. A door opened, and warm air rushed out, carrying the scent of jasmine. Just through the tea gardens, I think, she said. I hope you don't mind riding in a drone elevator. Laurent smiled. So we can go again? Of course, as many times as you like. Something broke inside him, but the fissure didn't open onto the familiar well of sadness. Laurent found himself laughing hard, almost hysterically, as he lifted the sled. Nara smiled quizzically, waiting as he gathered himself. When Laurent found his breath, the echo of his laughter still played at the edge of hearing. It was a wonder he hadn't brought an avalanche down upon them. He felt a small tear already freezing in the corner of one eye. Laurent? I was just thinking, Nara. You have a very clever house. 3. War prize. When a single nation's armies are ordered against each other, all is lost. Anonymous 167. Dead woman. The other came to her talking of darkness. There were no words, just grey shapes issuing from a moor inside a cave whose blackness invoked fairy lights upon her optic nerve. So dark that whispers rode the ears, her blindness made things calm and rich. Rich, but so many things were missing now. The keen edges of desire, the pleasures of flesh, all the appetites of drama, expectation and dread, hope and disappointment, all the anguished terrain of uncertainty had been flattened into an arid plain. And soon, the other explained, she would entirely forget the phantom shapes of those extinct emotions. It led her toward a blood-red horizon. She didn't know where they were headed, but she felt no worry.
The other explained that worry was one of those missing things. The dead woman took a deep, calm breath. No more fear, ever again. The red horizon opened up like the slit of opening one's eyes. Rana Hata, a voice said. The woman at the end of her bed was short and had the grey skin of the dead. She wore an imperial uniform, the dully glinting gunmetal robe of the political apparatus.
Yes, I know who I am.
She nodded. My name is Adept Harper Trevon.
Honored mother, she said.
The other had prompted her with the proper form of address. The other lived inside her like an organ, like a software guide, like a subtle form of second sight.
You will live forever.
Rana nodded.
Then a moment of disorientation troubled her as she wondered if she should be joyful.
Immortality was the highest reward her society could bestow on any citizen, an honor that had seemed utterly out of her humble grasp. But joy was such a gross emotion. Instead, Rana Hata closed her eyes again and regarded the subtle beauty of eternity, which had the pleasures of a geometrical simple, the ray of her lifetime extending indefinitely. But the question lingered. Why was she, a militia worker, a lower school dropout, and a recent traitor, one of the honored dead?
How am I risen, mother?
By the action of the symbiont. A trivial answer, using the outsider's word for the other. I was never elevated, mother. But you died at the hands of the enemy, Rana.
I died in the arms of my lover, she answered.
The self-damning word surprised her in a dull way, but it seemed that it was not within the dead to lie. The honored mother blinked. You were taken hostage, Rana Hata, a terrible experience. The minds of the living are fragile, and under stress they are bent with strange emotions. You suffered from a weakness called Stockholm Syndrome. Your love for your captor was a perversion caused by the fear of death, a need to hang on to something, anything. But now you have faced death and crossed it, and your mind is clear. Those feelings will pass.
The adept brought her hands together.
Perhaps they have passed already, and you spoke out of habit.
Rana Hata narrowed her eyes. The other prompted her to agree, but she found herself resisting. She remembered the avian precision of Herd's movements, the sure violet of her eyes, the alien pathways of her mind.
We shall see, mother.
The dead woman nodded, unperturbed.
You will discover your old life slipping away, Rana, and ultimately you will be glad to be free of it.
The honored mother held out a hand, and Rana grasped it. Trevum helped her rise to a seated position, and the bed reformed to support her back. Her muscles felt different, strangely supple and free of tension, but a bit weak. Rana looked around the room. The walls were a deep, rich color, full of shapes and suggestive motions, imminent with potential, covered with old and pure ideas. She realized that this eloquent surface was painted with the color she had once called black. It was more than a color now. The two of them were silent for a time that could have been a minute or an hour or longer. Then the honored mother spoke again.
Rana Hata, let me ask you some questions.
Certainly, mother.
The adept pressed her palms together.
In your time with the Rixwoman, did you ever see signs of another presence?
You mean Alexander?
Her eyebrows arched.
Alexander?
The compound mind, mother. It chose a name from the history of Earth Prime, the founder of a great empire.
Ah, yes. He died young, I believe.
Rana shrugged, a gesture of millimeters among the dead. Trevum looked pleased, as if she were already making unexpected progress.
The apparatus has reason to suspect that this entity possessed certain critical information.
Rana looked up at the black ceiling.
Alexander is information. All the data on Legis.
The honored mother shook her head.
Not all. There are some things hidden away, crucial secrets, but there is evidence that the compound mind went to great lengths to uncover them and to transmit them from Legis.
Why don't you ask it?
The adept frowned.
Have you spoken with this abomination?
Rana sighed, her mind returning to the halcyon days of her captivity, learning the Rix language and working under Alexander's guidance on necessary changes to the entanglement facility. Rana remembered the embrace of the compound mind, the security of knowing that practically every object on the planet was imbued with her lover's protector.
Spoken is the wrong word, mother.
But let me use the infrastructure and perhaps I can find an answer for you.